WBEZ is supported by Impact Grants Chicago. Over 400 women come together in a unique model of collective giving. Each member contributes $1,000, and together those donations grow into $100,000 grants for Chicago nonprofits that address critical challenges across the city. By pooling resources, individual gifts multiply into greater impact. Listeners can learn more about Impact Grants Chicago and past grant recipients at impactgrantschicago.org/join2025. This WBEZ podcast is supported by the Crown Family School of Social Work Policy and Practice at the University of Chicago. The master's program in social work, social policy, and social administration prepares professionals to address today's most pressing challenges and offers flexible options with part-time and evening classes to support busy adults balancing complex schedules. Inspire change, shape the future at crownschool.uchicago.edu/social work.
I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is Reset. It's almost June, which means that Asian American, Native Hawaiian, and Pacific Islander Heritage Month is coming to a close. Now, over the past month, we have shared the stories of South Asians and Vietnamese in our area, Native Hawaiians landing in Chicago for the World's Fair. And for our final conversation of honoring Chicago's Asian American communities, we're diving into the stories of the Korean diaspora in the city. We checked in with Danae Kovac, executive director of the HANA Center, which advocates on behalf of Korean, Asian American, and multi-ethnic immigrant communities here in Chicago. Grace Pai, who's executive director of Asian Americans Advancing Justice Chicago, and Ji Yun Ye, associate professor of Asian American history at Northwestern University. Now, I started with Professor Ye, and I asked her to give us a big picture of Korean immigration to the U.S. Who were the first immigrants?
The first immigrants to the United States came in the late 1800s, 1890s, early 1900s, and they came primarily as ginseng merchants and some students.
Okay.
Some exiles from turbulence in Korea. But the first, what we would call actual immigrants, were contract laborers who came to Hawaii. About 7,000 between 1903 and 1905. They were recruited by the owners of Hawaii's sugar plantations.
Interesting. And
they were recruited specifically to replace other kinds of labor that had been forbidden. So, for example, by that time, 1902, Chinese contract labor was forbidden.
Mm-hmm.
The Koreans were part of a long line of other Asian ethnicities that the sugar plantation owners had recruited and brought over to replace Chinese contract labor.
Mm-hmm.
But that was quickly shut down. And then you sort of went into a long period of Asian exclusion, where Asian labor migration was pretty much forbidden.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't until the 1950s, when you start to see Korean immigrants coming again.
So another wave.
That's right. And that wave is composed almost entirely of Korean women who marry American soldiers, immigrate as their wives, and Korean children who are adopted by American families and immigrate as their adopted children.
Mm. How did the 1965 Immigration and Nationality Act change things or impact things?
It changed things very much. So it opened up for Korean Americans specifically the professional labor migration. And the first wave of that began in 1968, 1969, and those were primarily doctors and nurses. It also opened up a wave of family reunification migration. So remember all those military brides who came in from Korea?
Yes.
They have family in South Korea, and they began inviting them to come in, and that became what we call a daisy chain migration. So in my research on military brides from Korea, I ran into a lot of women who said that, well, you know, they could account clearly for as many as 25 people who they had been responsible for sponsoring through Daisy Chain migration. Right? So that what that means is that Korean military brides were fundamental to the immigration of Korean Americans after 1965 Immigration Act. And it also means that that act is pretty much responsible for the majority of Korean immigration today.
That we see today. Yes. Now, each of you sitting in front of me, you have very different stories of immigration. So I'd love to hear some of your personal stories. Grace, why don't you go first?
Yeah, my family story is a little bit unusual because my great-grandfather on my dad's side was the first to immigrate to the United States, and he came in 1928, sponsored by missionaries to study in Iowa. So he actually landed in Midwest, right here where I am now. And he was the only one to come from his family at that time.
In the 20s.
Wow. Exactly. Imagine being an Asian man in Iowa in the 20s.
I can't picture it.
Exactly. Neither can I. But he survived. He, you know, pursued his education, built a career here. And later, my grandfather came as a young adult in the 50s to Hawaii. And my grandmother came separately to Hawaii at that time. My mom's side fits more into the story that Professor Yeo was just sharing with us. Her family came on family visas in the 70s. So on my mom's side, my mom was an immigrant, but on my dad's side, we go multiple generations back.
Mm-hmm. Danae, what about your story?
Yeah, so I was born in South Korea, and I actually came to the U.S. by way of adoption in the early 80s. So I was part of that part of Korean history, like Professor Yeo was mentioning. Excuse me. And South Korea has actually sent over 200,000 children through international adoption, and about half of them have come to the United States. And the late 70s, early 80s was really the height of that. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I grew up in Michigan in a smallish town, not a lot of Korean people, but I really started to get more involved in the Korean community when I moved to Chicago in the early 2000s and got involved with a Korean adoptee group here called Korean Adoptees of Chicago. And that eventually led me to Hana Center.
So the move to Chicago helped sort of shape your identity.
It did,
As part of the diaspora.
Yeah, and finding a lot of community.
Mm. Mm-hmm. What's your story, Professor Yeo?
Oh, well, you know, my father was a refugee from the northern part of Korea during the Korean War. And he landed in Seoul, or he ended up in Seoul, which is where he met my mother, who grew up in Seoul, but had been a refugee during the Korean War as well, mm-hmm. Going all the way down to Busan and then came back to Seoul when it was safe. And they married. My dad became an international student. My mom became a doctor. And when I was 5 years old, my dad was studying again, this time in Chicago at McCormick Theological Seminary. And my mom was tired of waiting for him to come back. And she applied to immigrate as a doctor. And that's how she and I came to Chicago in 1970. My dad was already here. And they were planning on going back. Right? But then Park Chung-hee did his military coup and declared martial law over South Korea. And my parents decided that that was not the kind of place that they wanted to be.
Mm-hmm.
And so we ended up staying.
You stayed here. Yeah.
So I came when I was 5 years old, grew up in Chicago,
yeah,
left for education, and then
you're back.
I'm back.
You just can't stay away, right? It has that effect for sure. So as I mentioned earlier, you know, the Hana Center has been advocating for a long time on behalf of the diaspora, Danae. And Grace, I know that different groups here have formed sort of a coalition, right? So talk to us about what's been accomplished so far and how the groups have gotten together. Grace?
The Pan-Asian Voter Empowerment Coalition is now 19 members strong, representing lots of different ethnic communities and the diverse Asian American community across Chicagoland. And we've come together because we know that the different issues faced by different ethnic communities within the Asian American community are shared. A lot of our communities struggle with issues like language access or access to citizenship, for example, or not seeing our histories represented in public education. So in 2021, we passed the TEACH Act, which made Illinois the first state in the country to require Asian American history to be taught in public schools.
Right.
And that was at a time of rising anti-Asian sentiment and racism related to COVID and the whole, you know, kind of political posturing around who's fault COVID was, supposedly. But we've continued to build on those successes to work on issues like language access. And last year, the PAVE Coalition passed the Language Equity and Access Act, which requires our state agencies to do more when it comes to providing translation and interpretation for people for whom English is not their most comfortable language.
Yeah.
You know, if you're applying for unemployment or navigating state services, you may need that extra help to understand, you know, what's fully going on. And issues like that really profoundly impact the Korean American community. You know, here in Illinois, more than half of Korean Americans say that they speak English less than very well. So you may be able to get by, you know, day to day, go to the grocery store, take your kids to school, that kind of thing. But when it comes to navigating complex systems, like many of our governmental systems, you might need a little bit more assistance.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Danae, what can you add to that about just sort of, you know, what's been accomplished so far and just the overall importance of Pan-Asian organizing?
Yeah, I would just add that HANA Center, you know, everything that we do is really grounded in being deeply rooted in the community and really listening to the community to understand what their needs are and being able to respond to those evolving needs. And so for us, that goes back all the way to 1972 when our first predecessor organization was founded, Korean American Community Services, in response to larger numbers of Korean Americans being in the Chicago area. And seeing the needs of these recent arrivals, as Grace was mentioning, language access is a big one, needing childcare for their children, right? English as a second language, applying for citizenship, all these things. And so they organized this organization to be able to provide these services and meet these needs. And then in the 1990s, there was another organization, Korean American Resource and Cultural Center, that really was founded by a lot of undocumented Korean Americans. Many people don't know, but 1 in 11 Koreans are undocumented in the U.S. And they really wanted to push for what at the time was called comprehensive immigration reform. And so it was a lot of young people working on civic engagement. And so it really started with voter registration. You know, they found out that a lot of people weren't registered to vote, didn't know how to vote. And so they registered about 14,000 Koreans in the area for to be able to participate. And then, you know, it's doing education to understand how do these systems work, you know, in this country that you're learning. And then they've gotten on to do a lot of advocacy. They worked, you know, really hard to advocate for the DREAM Act, sending pillows, you know, to senators with their dreams. You know, we've done a lot of other advocacy, and the youth have continued to do that. As Grace was mentioning, our youth were very instrumental in passing the TEACH Act. And then we've continued to also advocate for things like health care for immigrant communities, you know, getting the one driver's license for all last year so that everyone in Illinois can have that with the elimination of the temporary visitor's driver's license. So continuing to always respond to what those needs are that we're identifying with our community members.
Absolutely. Professor, why isn't there a concentrated Korean neighborhood here? Wasn't it once Albany Park?
Yes.
What happened?
Yes. Well, there are two things to kind of know historically about that. One is that concentrated ethnic neighborhoods, or ethnic enclaves, as they're often called, are a result not necessarily of communities wanting to be close together, but rather of being forced to be close together in a particularly tight geographic region or area because of racist violence and discriminatory, systematic sorts of policies such as redlining, right? So you see Chinatowns here as a result of racist violence, and you see black and brown neighborhoods here in Chicago as a result of redlining, for example.
Yeah.
Neither of those things really happened in a concentrated way for Korean immigrants in Chicago. And so what you had was that initial ethnic, oh, we're going to congregate here, and have businesses that are nearby, it makes sense, right? Just for convenience sake. And because once somebody knows how to do something on Clark Street, for example, then that knowledge gets passed down, right? So Clark Street was our initial area, and then Lincoln and Lawrence. Mm-hmm. But now,
they're all over the city?
They're all over the city, and they're also increasingly all over the suburbs. So residentially, Korean immigrants, Korean Americans live everywhere from downtown Chicago all the way out to Naperville further west, all the way up in Gurnee, all the way down to Oak Brook, Oak Park further south. In terms of commercial areas, there's still a little bit of concentration.
Yeah.
And you can sort of tell where they are because, for example, H-Mart will anchor them.
Oh.
Right?
Okay.
There's also in out in the suburbs, close, a little bit closer to Chicago, that stretch of Milwaukee, between Milwaukee and Dempster, up north, all the way up to like Milwaukee and Dundee in Northbrook. Along that stretch, you have Korean language newspaper offices, Korean banks. Korean restaurants. Another major Korean grocery store, Jungbu Market, which is as big as H Mart, the store itself, but it's a local Chicago grocery store rather than national
spread.
Chain.
Yeah, yes,
quite
this
the
is,
spread.
This is good. Any misconceptions that come to mind right now about Korean American or Asian American communities that you want to challenge?
You know, in general, Asian Americans and Korean American communities are painted with too broad a brush, right? We're seen as a monolith, that we're all the same. We all have come for education, for example. But that's just simply not true. There's a lot of economic inequality in the Korean American community and in the Asian American community. There are a lot of struggles to access basic resources, healthcare, employment, a lot of barriers that are still in place that impact Asian Americans and their everyday lives. And so I think in general, you know, we see a kind of flattening of the Asian American community. And part of that is because we don't have disaggregated data. When we see statistics, right, if Asians are included, which is not always a given, if they are, it's just one average number. And that hides so much of the diversity and difference that does exist within our community.
Yeah. Your thoughts right now, Danae, on just the attacks that we're seeing on immigrant communities at large from the federal government, right? How is that impacting the work that you're doing?
Yeah, those attacks are unfortunately also very much impacting our community. I think another negative stereotype is that our community is very insular, and that's definitely not something that we find to be true. You know, the Korean American community, especially in Chicago, and especially in immigrant rights work, has always done a lot of work in coalitions and multiracial, multigenerational coalitions. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we were the ones who were, you know, on the front page of the Tribune, you know, in the early 2000s, helping to lead those multiracial marches and protests about immigrant rights. And so mm-hmm. we are seeing, you know, those attacks in our communities as well. And we, along with many of our partners, are doing a lot of Know Your Rights education and making sure that, you know, there is language access so that people have that information and can utilize that in the language they feel most comfortable in.
Just have a few seconds, Professor. What feels most important to you right now for the fight?
I think for the fight, there are two things, actually. One is to really continue the solidarity work mm-hmm. with other ethnic and racial communities. And two is to really expand our idea of what is Korean yeah. and what is a Korean American, right? So some of that diversity you see here among the three of us, but Koreans in Chicago are Koreans who have lived and worked, maybe been born and raised in South America, Japan, China, yeah. and migrated to the United States, North Korean refugees, Koreans from Central Asia. Mm-hmm. So we're not all just from South Korea.
As I think Grace said it best, not a monolith.
Not
right?
a monolith, exactly.
Even among the diaspora.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Also, we're not just monoethnic and monoracial.
Yes.
We have mixed Koreans. Mm-hmm. We have multiracial families.
Yeah.
Right? And that's really important for us all to remember, I think.
So glad you were able to join us. That's Ji Yun Ye, who's Associate Professor of Asian American History at Northwestern, Grace Pai, Executive Director of Asian Americans Advancing Justice Chicago, and Danae Kovac, Executive Director of the Hana Center. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This episode of the Reset Podcast was produced by Ellie Gilbert Bear. It was edited by Dan Tucker and mixed by Ari Mejia. Chicago is chock full of culture, art, music, history, and more. And we want to make sure that you get it all. Hit subscribe to follow us and visit us at wbez.org/reset. I'm Sasha Ann Simons. Thanks for tuning in.
My name is Donald. I live on the southeast side of Chicago. I support WBEZ because of the balanced reporting and covering so much about an issue as opposed to just the few seconds that you may hear on most other news outlets. It matters to me to hear the story more completely.